This podcast of The Business is a production of KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9 FM, webcast at kcrw.com, and distributed by NPR.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Sony Pictures, presenting All the King's Men. Sean Penn leads a cast including Sir Anthony Hopkins. All the King's Men is in theaters September 22nd.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business? You think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really gotta rap and be all that. But prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, the Ragin' Cajun, James Carville, comes to Hollywood to produce his first movie. Is The Business any different than The Beltway? Then, first Tom Cruise is kicked off the Paramount lot, and then the CEO of Viacom gets axed. Who's next on Sumner Redstone's hit list? But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Stick around, it's The Business from NPR. We start with news of the ironic. American Idol runner-up Clay Aiken will be named to the President's Committee for People with Intellectual Disabilities. In less ironic news, when the UPN disappeared last year, it left many News Corporation-owned TV stations without a network and with a huge programming hole. As it happened, News Corp owned the American rights to a number of telenovelas, so they decided to turn their jilted TV stations into an ersatz broadcast network. Dubbed My TV Network, it launched last week carrying a bunch of telenovelas to fill the airtime. Desire, a Latin-style English-language soap about two brothers in love with the same woman, averaged a piddling 0.7 rating among women and an even lower 0.5 among men. Fashion House, starring Bo Derek and Morgan Fairchild, managed only 0.8 among women and a 0.7 rating with men. With numbers like these, My TV Network will find selling the telenovelas to advertisers muy difícil. Interestingly enough, Ugly Betty, ABC's Americanized version of the wildly popular Colombian telenovela Betty La Fea, is one of the most highly anticipated shows of the new TV season. Finally, we end with news of the surreal. A month after website TMZ.com uncovered the shocking anti-Semitic tirade from a soused Mel Gibson, the celeb and industry news website landed another big but drunken fish. TMZ reported that Paris Hilton was arrested for a DUI on a 2 a.m. run to In-N-Out Burger on the Sunset Strip. And now, The Business brings you the latest celebrity alcohol news. Tara Reid was seen at the Bar Marmal in Los Angeles last night, inexplicably, stone cold sober. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up later on The Business, laissez les bons films rouler. But next, Sumner Redstone's on the rampage. Over the last 20 years or so, Sumner Redstone built Viacom into a billion-dollar media empire. In 1985, he bought MTV, which would become the company's cash cow. In 2000, in the waning days of synergy mania, Viacom merged with CBS. 5 years later, Redstone unmerged the companies. He appointed MTV veteran Tom Freston head of Viacom and TV giant Les Moonves to the helm of CBS. And now, just a week after he publicly demolished Paramount's deal with megastar Tom Cruise, he has fired Viacom CEO Freston, replacing him with longtime loyalists Philip Dowman and Thomas Dooley. Among the reasons for the firing was that Freston ignored Redstone's specific instructions to buy MySpace.com, the social networking site that's so popular with the kids. It's true that MTV's online traffic is dwarfed by MySpace and even YouTube, but Redstone publicly cited Viacom's sagging stock price for the firing of the well-liked and well-respected Freston. Ironically, though, 2 days after Freston's firing, the stock was down 15%. Marissa Marr is an entertainment business reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Marissa Marr, welcome back to The Business.
Nice to be with you.
So how is it that Tom Freston, who is a lifelong MTV dedicated servant, gets shot out of a cannon?
I think he just, Viacom didn't perform, and Sumner Redstone has got to a point where he doesn't want to sit around and wait for something to be fixed. He wants to make decisions quickly, and we saw that with Tom Cruise and Paramount cutting Tom Cruise loose. He became impatient with that situation and decided to publicly deal with it. Now what we see that he's been unhappy with Viacom's stock performance and also with the fact that it's lost out to a couple of key acquisitions. And I think Sumner didn't want to wait around. He felt that Tom Fresten hadn't stepped up to the plate as a CEO, and he wanted to deal with the situation right away.
And at 83, I suppose he doesn't have a lot of time to wait around.
Well, yes. I mean, he obviously says that he's very healthy and is probably going to live forever. But yes, at 83, you probably do become a little more impatient, and you don't want to sit around and wait for things to work themselves out.
Well, I don't want to ascribe his impatience to his age, because, in fact, it's probably fair to say that he's done this kind of thing before. I mean, if you look throughout the past history of Viacom, Frank Biondi and Mel Karmazin sort of met similar fates, fair to say?
Yes, I think that if you work for Sumner Redstone, you have to factor in the likelihood that you're going to get fired at some point, especially if you're the CEO. So I think that this has happened in the past and is you know, may happen in the future, but it is something that someone has done in the past.
Well, but I mean, that's to simplify it. I guess what I'm trying to suggest here, I want to see if you agree with this premise that these two former CEOs, Frank Biondi and Mel Karmazin, sort of, you know, suffered from Redstone's itchy fingers to the desire that he seemed to have to not be marginalized, that no sooner does he appoint a CEO that he seems to want to take the company back and run it himself. It seems to be what he did with Frank Biondi. Do you buy that premise at all?
I think that he just, you know, once he sees fault in a CEO, he has very little patience. And he, rather than trying to fix it, he would rather just start again and put someone new in the job.
So tell us about these new people who I guess are not that new in the sense that they've been at Viacom for some time, right?
Yes, they're two of Mr. Redstone's trusted advisors. Philip Doman, who's the new CEO, actually oversaw the acquisition of Paramount originally and the subsequent Blockbuster deal that they did. He's been with the company for a long time and is one of Mr. Redstone's closest advisors.
What do we know about him personally?
He was previously a general counsel for Viacom. He was a lawyer, and he spent a lot of time in the legal profession. He hasn't had really an operational job in the media space in recent years, but he's had a lot of experience at deal making and in the media industry.
Is this someone who is sort of functioning as a CEO, or is he someone that that Redstone ultimately controls, so to speak?
He knows that he can work with him, and he's worked with him before, and he likes what he has done in the past. I mean, his focus was very much on the stock price, and he had some success in that area in the past. So that's something that Sumner obviously approves of, and so he knows that he has the qualities that he wants in a CEO.
So what should we expect from Philip Dowman? Is he got a checkbook out and ready to buy YouTube?
Well, I was asking him yesterday about Paramount and whether he would consider buying DreamWorks Animation at some point, because that's a deal that has long been rumored. And he said that he wasn't considering any big transactions for now. However, you know, the fact that Sumner has been so frustrated with Viacom's lack of presence in terms of acquisitions must mean that they will be on the hunt quite aggressively for other acquisitions for other parts of the empire.
What will be the fallout from this? I mean, who else might have their head severed other than Tom Cruise and Tom Fresten? It's kind of a bad time to be named Tom at Viacom.
I think there's a big question mark over Brad Gray and whether he will want to stay. He joined Paramount to work with Tom Freston, who is a friend of his, and he enjoyed working with him. And now that he's not there and he's working with a very different group of people who will no doubt be focused much more on corporate issues and the share price and the performance of the company, I'm not sure that that's really what he bought into. But on the other side of the equation, there's a series of executives that within Paramount now that have been long rumored as possible backup plans if Brad Grey were to leave, including Stacey Snyder, who is working at DreamWorks at the moment. So it's not clear whether Brad will ultimately enjoy working in this new environment, although he says. Philip Dumman says that that he has committed himself to the job and that he very much wants to stay.
How much does it cost to fire Tom Freston?
Tens of millions of dollars. It was a very, very expensive firing in terms of the corporate world. They had to pay him out of his contract, and it was an awful lot of money.
Mm-hmm. I've heard as much as $50 million, is that?
I think it was even a little bit more than that.
Really?
Yes.
But cheaper, I guess, than missing out on the next MySpace, I guess, in the eyes of Sumner Redstone.
In the eyes of Sumner. And also, Sumner would argue that the new contracts of the two new executives are much more focused on stock. And so they really need to push the performance of the stock price in order to make any money.
Marissa Maher is a correspondent for The Wall Street Journal and covers this area of Hollywood rather aggressively. We're delighted to have her back on the show. Marissa, thanks for being on The Business.
Thanks very much for having me.
Coming up next on The Business, should the Ivy start serving crawfish etouffee? James Carville's website describes him as the man who's devised the most dramatic political victories of our generation. In particular, he was one of the strategists of Bill Clinton's remarkable 92 campaign that would deny the first George Bush a second term. Though Carville no longer advises candidates in domestic elections, he still works on international campaigns. And again, according to his website, he is also, quote, an author, speaker, restaurateur, and talk show host. Now he can add executive producer to his list of credits for Steve Zaillian's new remake of All the King's Men. Robert Penn Warren's 1949 novel is a thinly veiled fictionalization of the fascinating political life of Louisiana populist and demagogue Huey Long. The new film, which, if I may editorialize here for a minute, is amazing, stars Sean Penn and features Jude Law, Kate Winslet, Patricia Clarkson, James Gandolfini, Mark Ruffalo, Anthony Hopkins, and Kathy Baker. But how did James Carville go from meetings in the Oval Office to lunch at the Ivy? We're pleased to have the Ragin' Cajun in our studios. James Carville, welcome to The Business.
Very good.
So, you are the executive producer of this film. Have you been able to discern what the hell that means? What is an executive producer?
Well, I think it's a title in search of a job.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think if you have something to do with the film and they don't quite know what to call you, then they just kind of call you an executive producer. But it sounds great. And I got two little girls, an 11-year-old and an 8-year-old, and I kind of like to. Yeah, what you up to, Dad? I'm kind of executive producing. I mean, it's good work if you can get it, and it's a damn good title.
Tell me about the road this movie took to the screen.
I had a cameo in a movie called Old School that Todd Phillips was
sure.
doing. And a guy named Scott Budnick, who
I know
the,
Scott.
Scott
yeah.
Okay, so we were kind of in between getting made up and kind of shooting the bull and whatever. And I said, you know, this is fun. I said, but all of my life I've really wanted to really make All the King's Men. I just love the book. I think the story is so incredible. And he said, you know, that's a damn good idea. And he ran into Mike Medavoy, who was an old friend of mine from the earlier Clinton wars. And so Mike called me and said, you know, God dang, I read that book and that'd be a hell of an idea. He said, you know, when are you coming out here? And I said, you know, in a couple of weeks, he said, let's go by and see Amy Pascal at Columbia, Sony, or whatever they call it. And so we went in, and she said, you know what, this is, you know, let's see if we can get a script written here. And so they called Steve Zaillian. And the only difficulty we had is they had some kind of writer, another Fox had some own part of the script about the novel. I forgot what it was, but they had to untangle a couple of legal things. And, you know, tell you the truth, it went pretty good after that. usually you hear these stories about so-and-so has an idea and they shop it and, you know, 15 years later, 20 years later, they get the movie made. I wish the story was that compelling, but actually it went pretty fast from sort of, you know, conception, inception to actually being a movie.
Talk to me about the differences that, in your estimation between Hollywood culture and Washington culture.
In Washington, people have a lot more power than they do money. The people in the Congress or the executive branch, at least they're supposed to. There are some exceptions if people got a hold of some money with the power, but they're not supposed to work that way. Here, the people, you have the money and then comes the power and the success.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect that both of them could probably stand a little flushing out.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with James Carville. He's the executive producer of All the King's Men and a Politico who needs no introduction. You've done lunch in Hollywood? Have you had a lunch meeting in Hollywood?
Yeah,
is that how it happened? But I guess what I'm interested in is how do they differ at all? Are there subtleties and nuances to a power lunch in Washington as opposed to one in Hollywood?
The food is different. It's probably, I mean, you start with that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the food out here is a lot lighter and
everything's wrapped in kelp.
And it's everybody in Washington always wants to say in this town because it's like there are only 500 people here. It's really a town wrapped in a city. I think it's the same thing out here that everybody fashions themselves of being one of the 200 people that count in this town. But in both places, you know, relationships count. And to know people or have friends, or it's kind of human nature. And by the way, that's true. And where I grew up in Louisiana, it doesn't, you know, if you knew the guy at the bank, you could get the loan. I mean,
you mentioned the little things about the meetings that are different. What are some of those things that come to mind?
In Washington, you know, if people tend to get to the subject a lot quicker than they do here. They're a little more kind of the niceties of life and the surrounding things. It's a little more Mediterranean, for lack of a better word, than Washington is. And in Washington, and people tend to be very sort of engaged and nice, and they tell you no much nicer in Hollywood than they do in Washington. That sounds like a great idea. You know, let me mull on that a second, and we're going to get back to you. In Washington, the people will just say, "Well, I just can't do that. I'm sorry." Just, you know what I mean? And at least in my experience, is people out here tend to be able to have a little more diplomatic way of saying no.
Hmm.
And people out here tend to be they're more creative. Some ways they're funnier.
Funnier how? What do you mean?
Well, they're more talented. They have a more of a in Washington, everybody is always the weight of the world. You meet with a congressional aide, you meet with a senator, a congressman, or a cabinet secretary. It's all based on kind of how busy you are. And, you know, the ultimate thing is to, like, show up at a party and have a security person with you or something. And here, you want to have the pretense of being so successful that you're kind of laid back. So if you go to lunch with at least my experience is you go to lunch with somebody that's powerful in Hollywood, they really engage you and Jim, how you doing, and so good to see you, what's happening back in Washington, how's the kids, how's Mary, and bloom, bloom, bloom. Now, what were we here for? Oh, you had an idea for this. In Washington, it's, goddamn, I was just in a committee meeting, and then I got to go down and I got to prep because I'm doing meet this weekend, and now tell me what's up, boss, what we got here. Okay, you know, what can I do for you? And boom. But, you know, again, my best example is, and I'm not sure they're not the same person sometimes, are Rahm and Ari. You know, and Rahm is turning into be Emanuel, as in the
we head should
of the,
be clear the, here, use yeah. our terms. Rahm Emanuel was a former Clinton
White House
aide.
Is now a congressman. And
Ari
chairman.
Emanuel is one of the most tyrannical talent agents in this town.
Right. But sometimes if I talk to Rahm, I talk to Ari, I don't know which one I'm talking to.
After a short break, more with James Carville, who, oddly enough, is one of the executive producers of the amazing new film, All the King's Men. You're listening to The Business on NPR. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business. It's not surprising that All the King's Men is one of James Carville's favorite bedtime stories. Robert Penn Warren's 1949 novel is a thinly veiled fictionalization of the fascinating political life of Louisiana populist and demagogue Huey Long. The Ragin' Cajun helped shepherd a new version of All the King's Men through Hollywood and acted as the film's man on the ground in his home state of Louisiana. For his efforts, Mr. Carville has earned the title of one of the film's seven executive producers.
You know, you could argue, I think, that in some respects, movies are a more potent form of American foreign policy than even American foreign policy in some respects. And given your associations with Bill Clinton and now your adventures in Hollywood, why not come out here and use the Hollywood pulpit, so to speak?
Well, first of all, I don't have the talent. I mean, what I found out is these are enormously talented people here. It's a little bit like if you're watching a baseball game, you go, gee, I could do that. And then you kind of stand up and you know what? I couldn't do that. And you watch a movie and you say, gee, I could play that role. And you go on a set or you see what they're doing and you say, no, I couldn't do that. And there's a sense in one thing I learned in two things. One thing that Hollywood and Washington have in common, I have interns that come by my office or I go and talk to people that come in from around the country and work for congressmen of both parties. What is the thing that you found out coming to Washington that you did not know before you got here? And by far, the most frequent reply is, man, these people work hard. All right? You go on a movie set, if everybody in the country worked as hard as people on a movie set work, our GDP would go up 10 times of what right. It is today. Hey, there's a sense that out here people just kind of sit around and go to lunch and don't do very much. Well, that may be some case, but that wasn't the case on what I've seen out here. And, when I first saw the script, people say, well, that's a terrific script. You got to read the script. Shit, I got two pages into it. I didn't know what I was reading. So, first of all, this was something I had a particular passion for. I actually did have a role that I could play. I wish something like this would come up again in my life. I doubt that it will.
What was the role? I mean, how do you see yourself as part of this movie?
Well,
other than the vaunted, impressive-to-children executive producer.
Executive. I think I helped. Was all filmed in Louisiana. I took people around, introduced them, got a lot of cooperation from, state and local officials, if you will, that we had there's a very good tax provision to get movies made in Louisiana. And I think I have some benefit in helping promote the movie. I'm, doing this and doing Jay Leno tonight and that kind of stuff. From time to time, I might have had a suggestion. I wouldn't call it substantial or anything like that, but stylistically or what kinds of names would be, you would use or what something would kind of look like. Maybe had a couple of ideas of location places, a place that might not work. But I would say my contributions to the actual making of the film itself, what you see on it, are somewhere between inconsequential and very minor. but I think I did help in doing some of the behind-the-scenes stuff, and I think I can help with the kind of promotion, that kind of stuff.
And your name attached doesn't hurt either. I mean, you bring a certain amount of credibility to a political film.
I think one of the things is I'm not altogether certain this is a political film, but for lack of another word, it certainly uses politics as a backdrop.
Well, it's a very dramatic film. I want to go there for a second, if we could. The movie was held for a year, and this turns out to be sort of propitious in a way because, unfortunately, that it took a tragedy of the magnitude of Katrina. But I think it re-injected into the American discussion poverty and the sort of third world poverty that we saw on television in a way that has not been part of the American conversation probably since the Great Society. Is there any desire on the part of the studio to acknowledge that in the marketing of the movie?
The movie was made essentially before the storm hit.
Right.
So you couldn't, it wasn't, we didn't have the storm in mind when
right.
we were making it.
But the premiere is going to be in New Orleans.
The premiere is
right?
going to be in New Orleans, and we're going to use it to raise money for a children's hospital and bring some attention. And I think it's all a good thing. No, I think if people will inevitably see it and draw a conclusion, but I know of no plan in the marketing to use Katrina as a way to market the film. Clearly, when it was made and put together, we didn't know Katrina would. We were through shooting by the time Katrina hit.
Yeah.
And the reason that the movie was put off is it just simply wasn't ready. I mean, frankly, the version now is a much better version. I showed a version of the movie in June in Washington. This is a much better. It wasn't ready in June.
It's like
much less
like slow cooked
right.
sandwich at Mother's. You know, with
yeah,
the
red beans
the
and
debris.
Rice. It needed to simmer. Exactly.
Yeah. You know, you sell yourself short when you say you don't have a lot of experience in Hollywood. But the traditional thinking is that it's a function of relationships and relentlessness.
Right.
And that's a business you understand. It's a business Bill Clinton understands.
Right.
Why not? I mean, are you? Some would argue, are you Bill Clinton's spy in Hollywood? Is he coming? Because one imagines that you too could cut a swath through this town, unlike and by the way, America wants to see that happen. I want to point out. So, come out and say it now. You are Clinton's advanced man in Hollywood. Are you not?
I think he has a lot of advanced people in Hollywood. He has a lot of friends here. I've been fortunate that I have some friends here also. But he hardly needs an advanced man in Hollywood. I don't think it. But and he's going to see the movie Saturday. I'm going to show it to him in his hotel room. He's actually going to happen to be in Toronto. He's got to do something else during the actual screening. But
uh-huh.
he's going to see the movie Saturday in Toronto.
At the Toronto Film Festival.
He won't see it at the festival. He's got another event, but I'm going to get a copy. We're going to set up something in his hotel room and show it to him.
Yeah, but that's
no
the red herring.
We don't see through that. Right.
James Carville is the executive producer of All the King's Men. James, thanks for being on The Business.
Well, thank you. And it's good to be in Hollywood, and I think we got a good film here. We'll see if we can have a good time.
Come back anytime.
Thank you, sir.
For your listening pleasure, here's Sean Penn in his role as Louisiana populist governor, Willie Stark. I'll bet you a bowl of gumbo his performance earns him his fourth Oscar nod for Best Actor.
There he is! There he is right there. There's the Judas Iscariot, Nick Spittle, nose wiper from the city right there. Come on, Tony. Look at him. Joe Harrison's dummy. Come on, take a bow. Come on, no, come on. There people want to see it. Take five. One, there, oh, there he goes. There he goes. Let him lie. Let him lie. Let that hog lie in his own filth. Let him lie. But listen to me, you hicks. That's right. I'm not the only one here. You hicks, too. They fooled you, too. Just like they fooled me 1,000 times. But it's time I fool somebody. It's time I fool them. Them big city striped pants, Nick Spittle, hick haters. I'm running for governor on my own. I'm coming for them, and I'm coming for blood.
We end our program today with a letter from the Business Mailbag. It's from listener Bruce Piscatello of Los Angeles. Bruce writes, "With respect to your piece, aired September 3rd, 2006, on the reason why Snakes on a Plane didn't do as well as expected on its opening weekend of business, all of you have your heads so far up your industry-lubricated back ends that you fail to see the 800-pound camel sitting in the living room. Plane travel today is fraught with enough problems and real-world terrors. Who, with a sound mind, wants to sit through an hour-and-a-half film depicting how it could be even worse? You guys are idiots." Thanks, Bruce. And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna and Thea Challoner. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com, keyword The Business. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.